I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is Haaretz columnist Bradley Burstyn. He's joined in conversation by the New Israel Fund's Jennifer Gorovitz. And now, join the New Israel Fund's Orly Bine on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Bradley Burstyn and Jennifer Gorovitz.
Bradley Burstyn is a Haaretz columnist and senior editor of Haaretz.com, which publishes his blog, A Special Place in Hell. During the first Palestinian uprising, Burstyn served as Gaza correspondent for the Jerusalem Post and was the paper's military correspondent in the 91 Gulf War. In the mid-90s, he covered Israeli-Arab peace talks for Reuters. In 2006, he received the Eliav Sartawi Award for Mideast Journalism, presented at the United Nations. A native of Los Angeles, Burstyn moved to Israel after graduation from Berkeley. He was part of a group that established Kibbutz Gezer between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. He served in the IDF as a combat medic and studied medicine in Be'er Sheva for 2 years before turning to journalism. Jennifer Gorovitz is Vice President for Operations and Administration of the New Israel Fund. She came to us from the national law firm of Manat Phelps and Phillips. Previously, Jennifer was CEO of the San Francisco-based Federation and Endowment Fund, and as such was the first woman CEO of a major North American federation. During her nearly 5 years as CEO, she was recognized in the Jewish Daily Forward's Forward 50 list and was selected by one of the Bay Area's most influential women by the San Francisco Business Times. Jennifer received her law degree from Georgetown University Law Center, BA from Stanford. Bradley, Jen, take it away.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I am so very honored to have the opportunity to be in conversation with you.
Thank you so much.
But of course, you're going to do most of the talking. However, let me just set the context for our chat. And I want to do that with a couple of observations, a story, and then a dilemma. And so my two observations are this, post-election, that are relevant for this discussion. I have many others. What I see for the very first time, and those, you know, folks like my mom who's here who've been around longer may have seen this at other times in our history. However, for the first time, I am seeing that progressive American Jews now understand in a really visceral way what the Israeli left has been going through for many years. Whereas before, I think it was a pretty abstract notion and one that could be pretty easily dismissed by a whole lot of people. The second observation is that really for the first time again, we in the U.S. are looking to our Israeli brothers and sisters for guidance, for advice, for help in building an opposition. An opposition may even be too passive a notion. Resistance is probably a more accurate term for what we need to do if the avalanche of atrocities that we worry about does come to pass. And interestingly, NIF grantees and NIF itself in Israel has been doing this work for many, many years. And are probably the most experienced on the ground. But whatever wisdom that you can provide us, we'll talk about later. I believe that's question number six. So those are, hopefully you have some stamina. So those are my two initial observations. And the other is a story. And I don't know if it's something that the rest of you have experienced post-election as well, but every morning when I go to open the New York Times and Haaretz, I have this anticipatory pit in my stomach about what Donald Trump is doing that day. And then in relation to our conversation tonight, about what he's saying or doing in relation to Israel or his minions are doing, and how could those things be further empowering the most sort of right-wing, ultra-nationalist, ideological settler folks within the Netanyahu coalition. You know, many of us are reeling, and we will be for a really long time. And our emotions have gone from disbelief to despondency to fear, and then to, oh, my God, what do we do? And I had several friends and family call me on the night of election and ask that very question. And they weren't calling for me. They were calling for my 19-year-old daughter who had taken the semester off to be a field organizer in Ohio for Hillary Clinton. And so I said, you know, I'll call her in the morning, but I'm really afraid to call her right now. And I called in the morning, and she sounded remarkably chipper. And I said, you know, all my friends want to know what to do. How do we move forward? And she said, it's easy, Mom. We just have to resist, and we start right now. It's all about activism. Find an organization you like. Find more than one organization. Volunteer. Give money. Donate your time. Demonstrate. We're now the opposition, and we have to get moving. There's a lot of work to do. 2018 is right around the corner. 2017 is right upon us. So, you know, no dilly-dallying. And that kind of says my 19-year-old to her 50-ish mother. So that sort of shocked me out of my despair on the couch. But the news just keeps coming, and it keeps coming in every day in ways that are hard to believe. And even since we penned the questions that we were going to talk about tonight, there have been so many noteworthy events, which poses our dilemma. In other words, we're not going to get to talk about all of these things tonight, but just know that we're not deliberately ignoring them. But since we talked about this stuff just a couple of days ago, we have seen from Trump's Kellyanne Conway a sort of chipper reiteration that Trump will make as a very high priority moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, that Netanyahu is delighted by this news, responding very positively. Don't forget that two previous U.S. presidents made that promise as well, and then once they were briefed, backed off on that. And then separately, we see the advancement of the outpost bill, which has to make Naftali Bennett very happy as we sort of pick up steam toward annexation of the West Bank. And then what we've been talking tonight, the Kotel bill, a bill that was just introduced that would ban all form of prayer and tallis wearing by women at the wall, and even on the upper plaza, there could be no services by anybody who's non-Orthodox. So the reform and conservative movements are absolutely beside themselves at this point. And this really is a slap in the face to Prime Minister Netanyahu, who has been, in his way, trying to work through this crisis of the Kotel. And it really really sort of creates the question of whether his rightward flank is something he really needs to worry about, and with Trump could feel very emboldened and pose very difficult situations for him. And so that leads me into my first question, or rather the prelude to my first question. So the election here has revealed on the one hand, and there are four on the one hand, so you're going to have to sort of track these as we go.
Okay.
A president-elect who has indicated and suggested cabinet members very sympathetic to the territorially maximalist position of the current white right-wing coalition. In other words, the ideological settlers, okay? A Republican platform that for the first time has taken out support for or reference to the two-state solution, which is a clear signal that Trump and his team do not see the settlements as an obstacle to peace. Then the ascendancy of the influence of the Jared Kushner family, who themselves have supported the radical settler movement, and then this possible movement of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. So that's all on the one hand. And then on the other hand, every U.S. administration to date, Republican or Democrat, has called the settlements an obstacle to peace. And they have been forthright about the illegitimacy of the settlements. So people might think that Netanyahu is rejoicing at this opportunity that a Trump presidency presents, and Israel is just going to barrel toward annexation. But on the other hand, isn't there the possibility that Obama and his administration have provided a convenient foil for Netanyahu to be able to keep that rightward flank at bay so that he could secure the largest U.S. aid package in history and so on? What do you think Netanyahu is thinking? What do you think he'll do? How is he going to respond to all of this?
Okay, so we're starting with the easy question.
I wanted to get you while you were awake.
About a week ago, I had this fever dream, and it turned out to be very useful. I think fever dreams at this point are more useful in understanding Israel and the United States than just about anything else. And I watched certain things go by, I remember. And I remember feeling something that I hadn't felt in many, many years in Israel, which was this feeling of, if only Israel were more like the United States. Well, we got there. And we got there in a number of ways. And one of them is, oddly enough, and this was also in the fever dream, that there's this bizarre hunger for monarchy, both here and in Israel, which is tremendously profound, seems to be getting worse as time goes on. The more capricious and unpredictable and ridiculous the ruler, the more regal that ruler seems, the more wasteful and influential the royal family is in sitting there on its wonderful thrones and spending money on God knows what, the more sovereign they seem. And that plays, I think, directly into the following and final depressing thought of my fever dream, which was, in fact, I didn't even understand it, but it was this kind of thing that I heard in my dream, which was that the battles that you fight in your life will only be won by your descendants. And obviously that, you know, dovetails well with the Talmudic kind of instruction that you probably won't finish this stuff, but you have to try. Right? I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, I don't pretend to be a Talmudist. Okay.
So
with those things in mind, let me try to approach the question.
Okay.
Right? All right, so what does Bibi want? Let's start with the last of the questions. Right? So what does Bibi really want? Well, what Bibi wants fundamentally, before anything else, is to remain prime minister until September 23rd, 2018, when he will finally and irrevocably and unquestionably pass David Ben-Gurion as the longest-serving prime minister in the history of the state of Israel. Longevity by itself is not one hell of a legacy. And I think he would be the last person to want longevity to be his legacy. He has some other ways to go. But what's his problem? Here you have this guy who can't seem to make peace. He can't seem to make war with Iran. Under his watch, you have a disintegrating public education system, an absolutely dying healthcare system, which was once an absolute example for the rest of the world. You have no affordable housing, unless you happen to be a millionaire in France and want to have something for weekends or holidays. You have racism on the increase. You have a society of tremendous divisions, which has turned tribal to an extent that no one can believe. We have 12 tribes at least, and maybe more, with very little intersection. He doesn't have a legacy. What he may have, and he doesn't know this yet for sure, but what he may have is Trump as an ally, maybe, right? So, sort of bearing in mind we're talking about two famously inscrutable, deeply insecure children of some bizarre outsider white privilege, both of whom have major trust issues. And of course, people with trust issues tend to foster distrust in the person that they're trying to gain their trust. So there is every possibility that even though Bibi may see Trump as this golden opportunity for gaining a legacy, either who knows, bombing Iran or who knows, making peace with the Palestinians. Who knows? I mean, he says that's what he wants. Even though he may seem that this Trump is a golden opportunity, he's also doing something else. And anybody who saw the interview with Bibi on, there was Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes, had to be impressed by this bizarre look in his eye, which was a person who was desperately, desperately trying to hide the fact that there's something that's frightening him. Something frightens him about Trump. And one of the things that frightens him about Trump is Bibi is a guy who likes a dependably dark night sky that doesn't change a lot from one night to another, right? He doesn't like allies who are loose cannons. And there is no cannon in the world presently looser than Donald Trump. All right, so you asked about the moving the embassy, right, which is one possible shoehorn into something approaching something like a legacy, right? At least that's the way Netanyahu seems to look at it. He's had his puppet Ron Dermer stumping. It's not clear who the puppet is and who the – but it doesn't matter. He's had his man Ron Dermer in Washington stumping explicitly for moving the embassy now for years, and you know, buttonholing every Republican congressman you could find to try to force the issue of moving the embassy to essentially to probably East Jerusalem. We don't know. It would make sense to move it to East Jerusalem, but it might not be East Jerusalem. But the point is to move it to Jerusalem, right? And so, what is the advantage? First of all, it may be harder to bomb Iran now that Trump is busy destroying Lockheed Martin and the entire F-35 program. So unfortunately, just when Israel's busy buying 50 of these things, they may not exist because Trump has destroyed the aerospace industry in one tweet. And at the same time, you know, like, here's the problem. You don't know which Trump you're going to get. You can get Trump number one, who's building up the military, which is a disaster, but he's going to fix it with his own generals. Or you can get Trump number two, who's destroying the F-35 program. This is the only plane that's going to bomb Iran. If anybody's going to bomb them, that's the plane that's going to do it, unless it doesn't exist. And it's possible that it won't because of Trump's tweet.
You're listening to Haaretz columnist Bradley Burstyn. He's joined in conversation by the New Israel Fund's Jennifer Gorovitz on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
You don't know which Trump you're going to get on Iran because you don't know if you're going to get the Secretary of State, who happens to have been the CEO of ExxonMobil and happens to have been in bed with Iran, Russia, and everybody else, and doesn't want to change the deal one bit. Or you could have the Secretary of State's deputy be John Bolton, who would be happy to see large swaths of Iran turned into a parking lot, right? You don't know on the Palestinian side if you're going to get, for example, General Mattis, who has said that if the settlements are allowed to continue, the two-state solution will be dead and Israel will move inexorably toward apartheid, and he used the word, right? Or it could be David Friedman, his expert on Israel, who also happens to be the president of American Friends of the West Bank Settlement of Beit El. All right? And chances are, and this is Bibi's perhaps is not happy about this idea, we're going to get all of them. We're going to get both of them and all of them. All right? It's possible also that if somebody is as impulsive as Trump, he wants both of them and all of them. But there is poor Bibi trying to figure out, you know, how to navigate through all this stuff. So all he can do in the Leslie Stahl interview is flatter. And he's there flattering. And that cannot be his most preferred position relative to Washington. But he's trying. He's trying his best. So the question, before I leave the whole question of the embassy, you might be wondering, why move the embassy, right? And what's interesting is, this is one of those things, Bibi's a genius at this, and Trump is actually really good at this too. This is another point where they come together. You come up with this idea which sounds completely reasonable and natural to your base and happens to be tremendously, humiliatingly insulting to some other group, which means that the other group is going to react really badly to it, and your base is going to say, look at these people. They can't listen to reason, right? The first example of this, I think, is the idea of when the Palestinian Authority has already recognized Israel, the existence of the State of Israel, just like every other Arab country that it recognized Israel in the same way they recognized it in 1993, right? So Bibi says, no. The Palestinians, and only the Palestinians, have to recognize Israel as a Jewish state, something that puts the Palestinian Authority in an impossible position with Israeli Arabs. But it sounds great. Why not? Israelis can't figure out why in the world Palestinians would not agree to this unless they want to end the state of Israel, kill all the Jews, and establish a Palestinian state in its stead. So the moving the embassy is another one of these things that's very, very similar. It's a brilliant idea, because what does it do? First of all, Bibi wants to stay in office. I mean, Bibi's thumbing his nose at the entire world. All right, so that's good for his base, right? It's also great for Trump. Thumbing your nose at the entire world is how he got here, right? Secondly, it expands this kind of symbolic recognition of the State of Israel to greater Israel, right? In other words, Jerusalem, it establishes a precedent. Now, everybody thinks it's the most ridiculous thing in the world that Israel's capital is not recognized. On the other hand, when you try to change it, you don't know what's going to happen. It could be nothing, or it could be catastrophe. Nobody knows what's going to happen, but it could be bad, and you can have the whole Muslim world on your head. But it expands recognition of of Israel. And that, to Bibi, is very important. Because when Dermer was talking 2014 to all the congressmen about moving the embassy, what he said was, this is the way you make peace. You make peace with truth. So you don't need a fever dream to figure this one out, because Bibi has a conception of peace which has nothing to do with people. He has a conception of peace which has everything to do with international relations, deals, alliances, and some form of symbolic recognition of Israel's status as a country, as a Jewish country, and everything else. Okay. Anyway, so you have those two reasons to move the embassy, but there's the third one, which is that if they actually do move the embassy, I think what in the back of Bibi's mind is the idea that there would be a domino situation where, who knows, maybe they can get Putin, our sudden best friend, to move his embassy to Jerusalem. And if he does, God knows who could move their embassy, right? And then Bibi has a legacy, right? Anyway, but let me just finish this by saying that what Netanyahu doesn't know could hurt him. And one of the things that he doesn't know, and no one knows, is the extent and the nature of Trump's relationship with Putin. And so that's why the answer is, I don't know.
Well, it's a cheery bunch of scenarios you've provided, nevertheless. I was trying to think of a clever segue into the next question, but given your conclusion, I'm just going to make a hard stop and move on. No, but seriously, given the number of really significant problems in Israel, you talk about the increase in racism, you talk about the increase in divisiveness. We see for ourselves the attacks on the human rights groups and on civil society. We nevertheless are hearing from people on this side of the ocean, people who have been tried and true, whether they are NIF supporters or people who just have always had strong attachment to Israel. Why, at this moment in time, should I give any attention whatsoever to Israel when this country is in crisis in a way that we have not experienced in many of our lifetimes? Can you reflect, as an American who made Aliyah and who really loves both of these countries while having deep concern for both of these countries, what do we need to do in order to help people to see that now is not the time to walk away from either country, frankly, that what we need to do is to really double down in preventing the kind of autocratic populism that we see emerging all over the world, and primarily, you know, in this country at this moment, with Europe on the way, what do we do to protect civil society and democratic institutions in Israel and convince people that that is still worth their time?
Well, I think, first of all, I understand why people would feel that way. I mean,
sure.
I certainly understand that. Since the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, I think it's fair to say that, and certainly since the rise of Netanyahu, which is now 20 years, Israel has become the canary in the coal mine of Trump's American experiment. Israel is the preview of what America could soon become. And that canary is lying on its side in Israel, gasping for breath. Israel is your window. I mean, it's a democracy which has become a one-party system with one-man rule the judicial branch is under siege, and worst of all, it's a situation where there are effectively no checks and balances. When you have a one-party system, which is what you now have here, and one-man rule, and a judiciary which is being undermined and denigrated and sidelined and bypassed, right? Basically, anybody who cares about both places, and probably most of the people in this room do, needs to start to become, personally, the check and balance that these countries are lacking. Because at some point, all that's left in terms of finding out what's actually going on, finding out what they're actually doing in government. Forget the tweets and the asinine comments and the stupidity and the infuriating, awful daily blast of, you know, four or five or six horrible things that you cannot stand anymore and that drive you nuts and you can't think about anything else. Behind all that, there is something going on. This is masking all kinds of terrible things. And it might be having to do with workers' rights. It might have to do with a thousand things, certainly women's rights. And you're seeing it already. That's the case in Ohio. My wife pointed out to me that suddenly these abortion laws, they've decided that if Trump's won, we're going to start putting forward abortion laws that are, you know, that'll put us back in a terribly dark period of time, right? In this country, right? And the Kotel law there, where there, a woman who puts on the wrong garment by this wall, which is presumably hers, according to this law, which is proposed by some of the sleaziest politicians in Israel. People who were procured, one guy who procured prostitutes at a casino is one of the sponsors of this bill, right? A woman who puts on a tallit could be imprisoned under this bill for 6 months and or 10,000 shekels fine. And let's say the bill will go nowhere, and let's say also, and Kasich vetoed this, the heartbeat bill, right?
Right.
But it doesn't matter because a lot of the damage is being done. There's this competition between politicians to see how far they can stretch this business, right? And what's the only thing that's keeping you from a total dictatorship? I'm sorry, there are two things. One of them is NGOs. And the second thing, and this is why the second thing becomes such an enemy, the second thing is a press which is willing to bring you the findings that the NGOs uncovered. Because if the NGOs uncover things but nobody knows, nothing happened, right? That's why the press has to be such an enemy. And that's why the NGOs have to be such an enemy. And that's going to happen here. And the NGOs absolutely have to be protected, and the press has to be protected. And it's only private citizens who are going to be able to do it, because there's nobody else left.
In other words, don't run away now.
Don't run away now. Love what you love. It's okay, you know? And sometimes you can love a country and be critical. Sometimes you have to be critical to love. Otherwise, it's not really love at all.
I know that you've written about whether there's a correct way to love your country, something that I would like to steer all of you to. It was an interesting piece. Moving on then to the next question. I don't think they're getting easier. How are Israelis reacting then to the U.S. election? given what they've been themselves going through for the past 7 years at least, and this is a compound question, I apologize, and within that sort of set of reactions, is there any reaction to the very dramatic rise in anti-Semitic behavior and actions in this country, unlike anything we have seen since 41 or earlier? And then, of course, that leads to the complete dismissiveness of any anti-Semitism problem in this country by Mr. Netanyahu himself, as recently as that 60 Minutes episode. You know, are Israelis tied to us as American Jews in the way that we always thought that they would be in our time of need? Is Israel there for us?
No. Journalists have tried, American Jewish journalists have been trying for a while to get Netanyahu to say something about the rise of anti-Semitism on the right in America. There was a convention of American Jewish journalists just a couple of weeks ago. And he basically said, well, it's a tangential, kind of a marginal phenomenon, not worth dealing with. And I think this is one of the most profound watersheds in American Jewish history and in Zionist history, and I'll tell you why. For a century, Zionist leaders, and more, and certainly for the last, 70 years, Israeli leaders, have been saying, and American Jewish leaders as well, have been saying, if anything, anti-Semitic attacks occur to Jews wherever they are, whoever they are, we will defend them. We will defend their rights and their person. And this is what we saw this year. We saw these same people who preached to us about the importance of fighting anti-Semitism and defending Jews wherever they are, saying the following: we will defend the rights and the person of Jews wherever they are, unless they are reform, conservative, anti-Trump, anti-settlement, liberal journalists. Every one of those leaders, including Netanyahu and all of the Likud and the Jewish home, and all of them who were pro-Trump and therefore silent, have forfeited the right to preach to you, because they're saying you're fair game. You're fair game. We're going to, because what do we care? What do we care? These aren't the Jews that matter. I don't know one journalist who wrote about Trump in a less than positive manner, who wasn't inundated with the worst, most vile anti-Semitic garbage, stuff that I have not heard literally since I was like 9 years old. When I was assured by my parents it was gone, it would never come back, that's it. You have no idea some of the stuff, and they got journalists' addresses and their kids' schools, and you name it. And nobody had anything to say about this. To their credit, by the way, the ZOA, which slavishly supported Trump, Bannon, and the others, was embarrassed, thank God, into saying something about this. And Mort Klein came up with a statement, which the head of the ZOA, which was very commendable and very passionate and very negative, like very strong about anti-Semitism on the right. But every other single Jewish leader, and certainly Netanyahu and everyone else in Israel that stayed silent about this, has no right ever, in my view, to tell you what to think about Israel, because when it came down to the Jews in America being under threat, they had nothing to say and did nothing about it.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Haaretz columnist Bradley Burstyn. He's joined in conversation by the New Israel Fund's Jennifer Gorovitz. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
There was something else here.
Well, the reaction of,
oh, yeah, the reaction of Israelis.
Israelis to the election
itself.
Okay,
I don't think we really have time for kind of a general spectrum of things, but I just want to throw out the idea that Israel really has recreated the 12 tribes. There's all kinds of different tribes there. They basically run along the lines of revolutions. Some of the tribes are like aging, like the labor revolution, which is kind of dead or dying. The settler revolution, which is sort of middle-aged and dying. The Shas revolution, which has decided that because it's not doing well, it has to come up with something like the Kotel law. Or, for example, and this is really terrible, the Shas revolution has decided that they have to do things like if there's a theologian from Malawi, from the World Council of Churches, who is unfairly accused of being a BDS supporter, and she's come for a conference. And if the Shin Bet interviews this woman at the airport and decides there's no problem, the head of the Shas revolution, Aryeh Deri, is going to deport that woman, and did, as a BDS activist, and the press went right along with it. It's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing. The problem is that there is no such thing anymore as Israeli public opinion. It goes along tribal lines. And the fact is, there's no such thing anymore as the Jewish people. We belong to a tribe of the Jews. Everybody belongs to their... Everybody knows which tribe they belong to at this point, of the Jews. There's no Jewish people. There are a bunch of tribes, and each one of us who is Jewish belongs to one of those tribes. Years ago, my wife and I were vacationing in Hawaii, and this is many, many years ago, and somebody asked us, where do you live? And we said, Israel. And they said, well, what tribe do you belong to? And we said, well, we don't really know. And what's interesting was that that person was a very strongly believing Christian, knew what tribe she belonged to. It was Ephraim and Menashe. I don't know. I can't remember exactly. But the point was they knew. We may as well know, too, because we have to go with our tribe at this point. We have to make sure that our tribe is healthy and moving forward and is not unfairly undermined by other tribes.
So if we can refer for a moment to the progressive movement as a tribe, then this tribe, up until now, for the last 8 years, has had a supporter in the White House, in President Obama, in Secretary Clinton as well, in John Kerry, who followed her. And they have been supportive of the civil society sector, of the human rights sector, in ways that were very public. So, for example, in 2011, when we were fighting against putting women in the back of buses in Israel, Secretary Clinton stepped in. When the anti-democratic NGO legislation in its worst form was first put forward, the Obama administration spoke out. U.S. Ambassador Dan Shapiro was on the front lines of that whole business. So what now will the civil society sector, the human rights sector do, and the progressive movement generally, to bring vocal support and some notice to its efforts in the absence of this administration? Is there anyone to turn to? And if so, who is that?
Yeah, it's a really important question. I think part of the answer has to do with, first of all, what is happening with the millennials? Because if you look at one of the more distressing parts of the election of Trump is the apparent feeling on the part of millennials that either the electoral process doesn't work, or it doesn't relate to them, or it doesn't make any difference. And by the way, and just to throw out one more way in which Israel and America have become the same place. Do you know how many? You know what the percentage of Bibi's vote was in 2015? 25%. He won with 25%. Think about this, and this relates to the millennials. They say that, and I'm not sure that it's possible the statistic has changed, but the statistic that I saw was that 49% of electoral voters, of eligible voters in the United States did not vote. Right. And that of the remaining 51%, clearly Hillary must have won more than half, which means that Trump won with 25%. And I think that the thing is that there are going to be millennials who are going to take active roles in civil society and here and there, and I think it's a wonderful thing. The question is, where is it going? I don't know millennials in the United States, I'm afraid. I know millennials in my own household, but they're over there. And I worry about this tremendously. And what I'm thinking is that there is, I think really that there's going to be a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian question, and that unfortunately I will not live to see it. I think what's going to happen is that a generation will arise, finally, which will say, our parents were idiots. And when that generation arises that says, my parents were idiots, then the big change will happen. But until that time comes, I think it's really, really incumbent on everybody to try to keep the flame going and keep the people who are working to keep others from being hurt supported and joined and as strong, you know, as strong as they can be.
That actually does provide a great segue, thank you very much, into my next question, which is, you know, what are the lessons we can learn from Israelis who have been fighting this fight for so many years? And what tips do you have for those of us who are looking for something to do? I know you wrote a great piece about this, and our own Libby Lenkinsky wrote a piece in Haaretz as well, entitled 11 Lessons that We Can Learn from Activists in Israel. So if you can give folks here something tachlis to hang on to so that before our descendants are old enough to do anything at all, we can feel like we're making a difference.
Okay, so here's a couple lessons from the collapse of the left in Israel. Do not ridicule the voters of the right. Do not condescend to them. Go after Trump. Go after the guys that really need to be gone after. But don't go after their voters. Respect them as human beings. In election after election after election in Israel, one person saying one stupid thing cost nearly the entire election. And it's happened over and over again. We went to a rally in 2015 when it really looked like the Labor Party was going to win. And Mayor Dagan, the former head of the of the Mossad, gave a tremendously passionate, moving speech. He was dying at the time about what was wrong with the Israeli leadership, and it was amazing. And then an art critic got up and ridiculed Bibi's voters as being, you know, amulet kissers and primitives. And I was thinking, that's it. It's over. Time after time after time. All right, so that's one thing. Another thing that you can learn from the Labor Party and how terrible it is, and forgive me, but I've been a member for 40 years, so I can certainly say this. You can't get rid of the membership, by the way. It's the another thing you have to learn, I think, is that parties need to make sure that they have candidates that young people get excited about. And I know it's not easy, and it doesn't, you know, come out of the air, and it's not also, it's not always possible. The third thing is, I think Jen was mentioned this, and it's really true. It mentions through your daughter, right? The midterm elections are going to be enormously important in the United States if they can make or break Trump, and anything that can break Trump is worth working for, it seems to me. Forgive me for stepping out of my whatever objective role I might have. But that's where it happens. You can't let up. You can't let up. You have to keep going. Then no question that you have to make common cause with people who are in other spheres of activism. And, you know, climate change, women's reproductive rights, gun control, access to health care, police-minority relations, whatever it is, you absolutely have to, you have to work for all of these things. And especially because what's going to happen, this is another lesson which I could have, you know, brought in earlier. One of the things that Bibi did is he found ways to have all kinds of smoke and mirrors, and all the time, basically, the one worst problem that Israel had kept getting worse, right? Which is the occupation. I think here, it may not be only one problem, but the obvious first problem that's like the occupation. In other words, if you do nothing, it'll get worse. And chances are there's an advantage in a person actually making the problem worse. The obvious start is climate change, because it's like occupation is to Israel as climate change is to the world. If you don't do something about it to try to reverse it, it could actually, you know, end everything. And then finally, I think the most radical thing that a Jewish person can do these days is also the most radical thing that a Muslim, and we're talking about both here and there, can do these days, which is talk to one another, meet with one another, have treat each other like human beings, one of the points of commonality between Bibi and Trump is that Bibi has a conception of human rights that has nothing to do with humans. And as long as Jews and Muslims can actually relate to each other as humans, this is a revolution of major proportions, even if it's just two people. So, let me go back to another question for a second. There's something that I realized I didn't say that I should have, that I actually know something about. One of the things that has given a small number of Israelis hope is the idea that you can possibly look differently at the idea of the two-state solution. That the two-state solution actually could have some sort of different expression than we've grown accustomed to thinking about it. Because the way we've grown accustomed to thinking about it is basically impossible. Is uproot 600,000 people and do all kinds of stuff. It's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. But it's possible that with time and changes in attitudes and people thinking that their parents were idiots, they may come up with some other form of expression for a two-state solution. And there's already one model for this, which everybody who hears it kind of goes, but it actually might work. It's called one homeland, two states, or two states, one homeland. And the idea is that if you look at the reality, you have settler kids being born in this place, like the fourth generation of settler kids being born in various places, and people really, really rooted to the place that they live, right? The idea of this is this: that you don't uproot a bunch of people. You have two different countries, one called Israel and one called Palestine, and you have citizenship. People who want Israeli citizenship will have Israeli citizenship. People who want Palestinian citizenship will have Palestinian citizenship. They will stay pretty much where they are, and because obviously uprooting people from their homes, no matter who they are, is one of the worst things you can do to anybody, right? And as soon as you take that element out of the equation, you start to be able to divide things differently. We went to a conference of this, and one of the most interesting parts of it was that the people who came, they were Palestinians there from the West Bank and Israeli Arabs and settlers and a certain number of right-wing Israelis, a certain number of left-wing Israelis, Jews. And I will leave you just with this one thought, which is from Rabbi Froman, who kind of came up with this idea originally. And what he said was, you have to stop thinking about the land of Israel belongs to the Jews, right? You have to start thinking about the idea that the Jews belong to the land, and so do the Palestinians. And as soon as you start thinking that way, you can start thinking differently about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So,
unfortunately, we're out of time, but Bradley, thank you so very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Haaretz columnist Bradley Burstyn. He was joined in conversation by the New Israel Fund's Jennifer Gorovitz. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelay, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rasha Neem Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.